How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at HollywoodBlends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. My name is Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is a popular actor who's brought us many great, memorable performances on the big screen. You've seen him in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, Dark Planet, Legal Deceit, Wag the Dog, Jekyll Island, Abominable, Cry of the Butterfly, Ghosts of the Ozarks, and he's the voice of Dr. Joshua Sweet in Atlantis, The Lost Empire, and he's the voice of Vandal Savage on Justice League Doom, for which he and his fellow cast members won two Behind the Voice Actors Awards. And on television, he's well known for his portrayals of Tyrone Jackson on The Young and the Restless, Grant Collier on Mission Impossible, Walter on Melrose Place, Jackie Chiles on Seinfeld, Chief Purser Will Sanders on Love Boat, The Next Wave, Martian Manhunter in Smallville, John Creighton in Bosch Legacy, Silas Stone in Doom Patrol, and Delroy Jones in Love That Girl, for which he was nominated for two NAACP Image Awards. He's also the voice of Doc Saturday in The Secret Saturdays, and his voice can be heard in a whole slew of animated series and video games. He's also guest starred in dozens of other iconic TV shows, including Heart to Heart, Webster, Knight Rider, Cheers, Murder, She Wrote, Beverly Hills 90210, Will and Grace, CSI Miami, Hot in Cleveland, Young Sheldon, and many more. I'm delighted to welcome the incomparable Phil Morris to our show. Phil, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Harvey. Yeah, my IMDb is lengthy, thankfully, gratefully, yes.
Not only lengthy, but prestigious. I want to start by paying tribute to your father, the legendary Greg Morris, whom we all loved as Barney Collier on Mission Impossible and Lieutenant David Nelson on Vegas. He was only 62 when he passed away in 1996. I hope, Phil, that you know he is so very beloved and fondly remembered by millions of fans.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that, Harvey. And yes, I absolutely know. And, you know, it's been a transition for me as a young man, as a young actor, to kind of make my way out of his shadow, as it were. As I go through this journey and follow this career, I respect and love him even more for what he's done and what he's done for me and done for other young African-American actors. And yeah, people come to me all the time and tell me about how much they love him. And I never hear enough of it, quite frankly.
We've had lots of children of great legendary stars on our show, and they've all said that being the child of a famous celebrity is nowhere near as glamorous as it sounds. Do you agree with that?
They're absolutely on the nose. You know, as kids, we don't see it. I mean, we really don't. And my father became famous when I was six. So it was difficult to really understand what was happening at the time. And you kind of go along with it. And if you choose to eke out a living in the same profession, then yeah, it can be difficult because they've made such a name for themselves. But in hindsight and retrospect, like I started with, the lessons that he and my mother gave me, the grounding that they gave us, growing up in Beverly Hills, living the kind of life that we lived, was invaluable. And they really showed us what being grateful was all about. And so every success my father had and every success that I have, I'm grateful for the blessings because nothing's promised.
Now, you played Grant Collier, Barney's son, the technical wizard in the new Mission Impossible back in the late 80s, which is a show that your father made famous, of course. And there was at least one scene that I remember where you got to work with your dad and play his son when he guest starred on the show. What was that like?
It was surreal. I mean, that they would choose to do Mission Impossible again, which was a writer's precipitated show at the time. And they wanted to use a show that they could only use the same words and the same characters. And Mission Impossible was ahead of its time. So they used that. That they would cast me, that I would be an actor at the time to be able to take the role. I mean, it was just too many factors were working in my favor. And it was just surreal. You couldn't really write it and it play, as it were. But living it was incredible. Having my father come down to Australia, which is where we shot it. And my mother to guest star on the show that he made famous, that I'm now starring in with my uncle Peter Graves. I could go on and on. It was just really beautiful, brilliant, challenging, difficult, because in the show, my father dies in my arms. And as you said, my father has been gone since 1996. So it was a bit of a precursor, but something that I will never forget and I don't think can ever be duplicated. I mean, truly special.
It was a very memorable episode for sure. And if I'm not mistaken, Phil, you also got to play your dad's lawyer on an episode of Vegas, right?
It was an episode of Superior Court, which my sister Iona was the star of, playing a character named Olympia Hall, a very forthright, aggressive DA. And I played the defense attorney for my father's character in that show. In Vegas, I played a young basketball recruit who was seen to be shaving points that Robert Urich's character, Dan Tana, was after. So I didn't really work with my father on that one. I was just on lucky enough to be on his show.
Well, for those trivia nerds out there, the episode that Phil was just talking about was in season 2, episode 12, called Lost Monday, right, Phil?
Yes, absolutely.
Now, I'm sure everybody's dying to know, was your dad an electronics wizard in real life?
No. He was not all acting. He had no aptitude for anything like that. He was literally all thumbs. He was a great athlete, but not an electronic intellect. No, it was all acting and technical advice.
Now, although your father is best remembered for his work on Mission Impossible, for which he received 3 Emmy Award nominations, by the way, I also have to mention a movie that I just saw earlier this week called The Jesse Owens Story. Your dad played the high jumper Mel Walker, and he was really terrific in that movie, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was great. He was great, and that was Dorian Harewood who played Jesse Owens in the movie, and they had a great relationship. And yeah, I mean, my father was larger than life, and those characters were larger than life, and he embodied Mr. Walker beautifully. And I was a high jumper at the time. Actually, I was a high jumper in high school and the captain of my high school track team as a high jumper. So it was great. He didn't come to me for advice though. What's that all about?
Well, I guess he didn't need it, but he was very memorable in that movie, and that is a very significant and historically important movie. Now, I know that your first on-screen work was when you were 7 years old in an episode of Star Trek, but when did you know for sure that you wanted to be an actor?
It hit me a couple of times, but never really stuck. I remember in one of my classes in sixth or seventh grade, I mean, I was young, we were doing a classroom presentation, and I played this drunk character that a friend of mine, Greg, had written, and it just killed. I mean, the audience, the class loved it. I loved it. It hit me for the first time. I felt something I had never really felt before. And then I did The Music Man in eighth grade at Hawthorne School in Beverly Hills. And played Marcellus, the character, his the Buddy Hackett character, and I did the song Shaboopey, which he sings, and I danced. I started dancing improvisationally at the time, and the audience was full, and it just absolutely slayed. And I was like, "Wow, what is this? What is this feeling? You know, I need more of this." Jump cut to when I graduated high school. My father got me a production assistant job on a film called Comtac 303. That was never finished, and I truly believe it was it only existed to start me on my acting career or in earnest, because my father was one of the stars, Billy Dee Williams was one of the stars, Henry Fonda was one of the stars, Chad Everett, Merle Haggard, Buck Henry. I mean, it was an amazing movie, which we shot in the Mojave Desert out here in California, and like I said, it never got finished. And as a result of that film, I said, "Dad, I need this." I was 17 years old. I need this. And so he got me a great acting coach, Guy Stockwell, who's the brother of Dean Stockwell. I mean, I could go on. And I came back to Los Angeles and started to study. And that's when it was like, this is it. This is me. I know this is me. It's not my dad. This is me. This is Phil Morris. So grateful for that experience.
Whatever happened to that movie? Why wasn't it finished?
Financial reasons. Rona Barrett, who was a great Hollywood gossip columnist, her husband was the financier with Paramount Pictures. And they ran out of money and Paramount didn't want to pick up the back end of it. So it just languished. And I'm sure it's sitting somewhere, the negative somewhere. And it's a really good movie that if anybody wanted to kind of do a resurrection of it, since it was never done, it was about the African-American Air Force Division in Anzio, Italy during World War II. And my father and Billy Dee Williams played the lead pilots and Henry Fonda was the lead general. I mean, it was amazing.
Well, that's just heartbreaking. Well, Rona was on our show a few months ago. I should give her a call and ask her to find that footage.
I would love to see that stuff. I played Billy Dee Williams' Jeep driver in the movie.
And that's also a very important, historically important story that should be told in a movie. So I hope that it does get made. And I hope you're in it.
Thank you. We'll manifest this, Harvey. You and I will manifest this.
Well, I believe in that. Did your dad ever give you any career advice?
Yes. The best advice he ever gave me was that never work a day in your life, play. And you're a team player. Doesn't matter whether you're the star of the show, number one on the call sheet. This cannot be done with one person. It is a collective effort. It is a village of entertainment and expression. And you are a part of that village. You may be an important part, but you're just a part of that village. So work well with others. Listen, learn about the other crafts, the other departments. And, you know, and that was the best advice he could have given me, because when you go to a set, especially as many guest star episodes as I've done, you're always new. I mean, you're always like the new kid in school. There's new students you got to meet, new teachers, new principals. And so you have to take a certain amount of graciousness with you and a certain amount of respect in order to fit in to the proceedings that will go on after you leave and were going on before you showed up. And having done that, I think, well, it gives me great relationships and it gives me the opportunity to work in other shows, because they go, we like this dude. It's hard. It's hard making TV and movies. It just is. When it's good, it's hard. So you want to work with the people that are best served to work with. And that was the best advice my father probably could have given me.
Well, the advice that he gave you was not just verbal. It was in his actions. He was well known to be a real gentleman and such a team player. And one of your other major mentors was your uncle, Peter Graves, right?
Oh, absolutely. And to work with, I mean, it's surreal, right? I grew up, I learned how to swim at his house when I was a kid, small. I remember telling my sisters one day, I'm going to learn to swim today when we go over to the Graves' house. They were like, get out of here. I learned to swim that day. So jump cut to them doing the new Mission Impossible. And Peter requested to reprise his role, which they accommodated. I auditioned the last minute. It was like the last chopper out of Nam, really. And ended up winning the role. And it was, again, surreal that my Uncle Peter would be there, that I would be working with him, having grown up with him. We would call each other every week and talk about the work. We played tennis all the time together. He was a great tennis player. And his wife, Joan, and my wife got on great. And, it was like being amongst family all the way down in Australia, which is where he shot a show called Whiplash decades prior. So he was really helpful in many, many ways.
I love that you're standing on the shoulders of giants. Now, you were in an episode of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air called Take My Cousin, Please, which is very often shown in reruns, almost more than any other episode. So I want to ask you, is it true that Will Smith liked to play chess on the set?
Yes, he did. We played chess every break we had. And Will's a very bright guy, was then, is now. I think he wanted to go to MIT, but his acting and rap career got in the way. That's how bright this man is. And so I'm not a terrible tennis player. I'm a great tennis player, much better tennis player than I am a chess player, but I'm not a terrible chess player. So we would go play chess and he would kill me. I mean, just whoop, wipe up the floor with me. And then one time we're in his room and it's obviously Will Smith. It's a great dressing room. It's at NBC. We're playing and there's a knock on the door and he looks at his watch and he goes, Phil, we got to cut this short. I got business to take care of. And I walked out. There's his lawyer, his business manager, his agent. Everybody was there for business. Will knew what time it was. He played when it was time to play. And he worked when it was time to work. And when I met him, you know, we're actors. I've been studying for a long time. And this cat gets this show, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. A lot of us were not happy, to be honest with you. We're like, dude, rappers are getting the things now? What? But when I worked with him, I told him, well, of course you have this show. Of course you're this guy. You're every bit of what we all want to be. You have the charisma. You have the presence. You're smart as a whip. You're a good man on the set. You were wonderful with me. Very supportive. Congratulations, Will. That was very hard for me, but that was very hard. But yeah, he was that guy.
See, you took a page out of your dad's book.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, one of your most bizarre roles was in 1986 as a law enforcement officer, Tyrone Jackson, on The Young and the Restless, and they required you to go undercover as a white guy. What went through your mind, Phil, when they made you do that?
Well, I conferred with my father. I said, look, this is what they want me to do. This is their plan. What do you think? And he was like, well, son, a lot of white men have played Othello. So I think if it's in you to do and it's not going to compromise you and you don't sell your soul in any way, do it. And so I did it to the best of my ability. And they won every Emmy under the sun. Best show, best writing, best makeup, best hair, best all of that. And I presented best makeup to my guys at the Emmys that they had at Century Plaza for the departments. And it was amazing and very difficult all at the same time. I thought it would be just for a short period of time, a week, a couple of weeks, maybe. It was like 4 or 5 months I was in that makeup. And it was challenging for me to continue to justify playing this character culturally, racially, artistically, but I just committed. And I do not look back and regret. I think it was phenomenal. I think we did an amazing job and I'm very proud of the work.
Yeah, it's quite a milestone, and I think it makes you stand out. Certainly, of all the actors I know, I don't recall anyone else having been made to do that. Now, of all the roles you're most identified with, if I were to make a guess, I would bet that you're probably most often recognized as Jackie Chiles, who was Kramer's lawyer on Seinfeld. Am I right?
I am most loved as Jackie, but rarely recognized as Jackie. Because I had the mustache and glasses, and I've just recently started wearing glasses because I'm not a young man anymore. But yeah, I mean, it's, when I start speaking, I think people realize, hey, are you, I've heard that voice before, but they don't put it together. I mean, a friend of mine one time said, you're Jackie Chiles? It's a friend of mine. And he goes, you know what? I'm never going to argue when Clark Kent puts on glasses again and people don't recognize him as Superman, because it was such a change. But yeah, I think that Jackie Chiles is obviously the most beloved character I've ever done. It's the one that's been the most watched. I mean, 80 million people watched the finale of Seinfeld. I know I had 20 people in my house. So you multiply 80 million by about 5 in everybody's house. And that's the real number. I don't think anybody else I don't think ever get watched by that many people again. And I think in the show that Jackie was resonant in, Seinfeld, that was very, very special. That's a once in a lifetime gig, man. And Jackie delivered.
Yeah, Jackie delivered. You did a great job. I think it's pretty clear that Jackie Chiles was a parody of Johnny Cochran, who represented O.J. Simpson at his murder trial. Did you ever meet Johnny Cochran?
Well, you do such good research. Thanks for the leading question. I'm sure you know, Harvey, that I went to the same barbershop as Johnny Cochran as a child. It was called Terrell's. And it was owned by the brother and sister of Ernie Terrell, who was a heavyweight champion from Chicago. And they came west, opened a barbershop. Every illustrious African-American went there, athletes, actors, attorneys, all the A's. And Johnny Cochran was no different. He was a public defender at the time. He was driving a black Seville. I'll never forget it. And they would argue and pontificate about everything, from the Raiders moving from Oakland back to Oakland, the whole nine. And so I heard these arguments, discussions, dialogues, my whole upbringing. And Johnny Cochran was prevalent and prominent in a lot of them, not knowing that I'm doing unconscious history and character study on him, the same way I had no idea I was doing unconscious study and history on the character I played in Mission Impossible, having just grown up in that household. So yeah, I got it. I got him. I knew who he was. I wasn't acting. I was channeling, if you will, to a great degree. A little street corner preacher, a little hustler, a little Greg Morris, a lot of Johnny Cochran.
Well, it really worked. And it's another example of the synchronicity that has happened in your life. Now, in 2010 and 2011, you made 4 short films about Jackie Chiles, Introducing Jackie Chiles for the People, Jackie Chiles Knows Barack Obama, Jackie Chiles Knows the Internet, and Jackie Chiles Knows Tiger Woods. How did those movies come about?
It makes me laugh just thinking about them. I had a manager at the well, no, I had a manager at the time, and I was going through some stuff with the manager. I wasn't thrilled with them, and I went to who is now my manager, Christopher Barrett, who owned an agency then. I knew him. He was instrumental in putting the package of Mission Impossible, the series, together. So he knew my work, but he was not my representation. And I went to him and I was like bitching and moaning and complaining about my career. And he's listening. And he just said, Phil, there's so much that you can do that was not available for your father to do. You can self-generate projects. It's cost effective. If I were you, I would start with like a Jackie Childs something. And I was like, really? He goes, yeah, really. So that's exactly what I did. I wrote with a friend of mine, Whit Hertford, who's a wonderful actor, who actually was the little kid in Jurassic Park, the original. And we wrote these interstitials. And Funny or Die had just really started then. And we went to Funny or Die. We knew some people over there. We told them what we had. And we ran it through Castle Rock and Warner Brothers and Jerry and Larry. And they signed off on it. And they didn't adjust anything. Every word perfect. We went with everything we wrote. It was fantastic. So Funny or Die gave us a director, gave us a crew, gave us their offices. We shot them all at Funny or Die's offices. I got my really good friend Dietrich Bader, who's just a brilliant man, to come in and play a character in it. And I came up with these concepts. It was like 1-800, call Jackie Childs. And I thought they were really, really special. So thank you for mentioning them. They're out there, people.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to mention them. I want everybody to look at them. They're terrific. And didn't you do commercials for Snyder's of Hanover Pretzels in the character of Jackie?
I did. I've done a few campaigns. The first one was the Honda Odyssey that the Coen brothers had written and directed. And they literally wrote these commercials leading up to Jackie Childs coming in and boom, bursting through the door and saving the day, I suppose. And I did Dr. Diet Dr. Pepper. And we just did the Snyder's of Hanover pretzel pieces. And that campaign just finished about 6, 7 months ago. And then I did a commercial for Jerry for his movie Unfrosted. And then we did a Capital One commercial with Charles Barkley, Spike Lee, Sam Jackson, and Magic Johnson as Charles's lawyer, a parody on Jackie, but I was the actual lawyer. So Jackie follows me. I can't get rid of this dude, Harvey.
I don't think you should. In fact, I'd like to see a spin-off. I think you should have your own show. Like Better Call Saul was a spin-off of Breaking Bad.
Yes.
What about the Jackie Chiles spin-off?
That's a tough one. Not because I don't want to, not because people like yourself or the audience doesn't want to. It's a bit of a Warner Brothers philosophy thing. They feel that Seinfeld is the perfect show, and to spin off the perfect show, they feel is a bit sacrilegious or would be disrespectful to the Seinfeld legacy and canon. That is their feeling, and I respect that. They will allow me to do these interstitials in the short form. But the long form may be a bit out of my reach, unfortunately.
Okay, there's something else we have to manifest.
I'm with it. I'm with it. And I love Warner Brothers. I have no ill will. I respect them. They have been incredible to me. I've worked for them for my whole career. I hold zero will ill will. I think it's, if I didn't need them, I wouldn't go to them. But I need them. And in needing them, they have their business mission statements, and I have mine. And we will do great business together on something else in the future. It just might not be able to be Jackie, that's all.
Now, you mentioned the finale of Seinfeld. It was seen by well over 80 million people. What was the atmosphere like on the set for that final episode?
You'll get this. It was like a Beatles reunion, really. They were like, this is once in a life. This show is leaving us. It was so incredible that the scripts they gave us had gold. They were gold, covered gold. But we had to give it back every night. We couldn't take it home. We couldn't write notes on it. We had to know what we had to know and give it back every night. And only a few people were given those gold scripts, like the golden ticket at Wonkaville. My wife would drive me to work every day in her car. I would lay down in the back so nobody knew it was me coming in. Nobody could know I was doing it. There was no social media at the time, so there was no way to leak it in that sense. But it was as big as anything I've ever done in my whole life, and will probably ever do. And every single person in that gallery, in this picture behind me, right there, They all were talented enough to have their own show, and many of them did. And it was just an incredibly surreal experience. And the last thing I'll say is I was doing the new Love Boat at the time, the next wave, with Robert Urich, who was another person my father worked with on Vegas. Again, surreal. But I was doing that show on the water, doing exteriors in the Caribbean. I come back on a Friday. That evening, they say, you're starting Monday on the final episode of Seinfeld. What? Oh, okay. So I went from doing the number 101 show to the number one show. And it was just fantastic. So I would do my day job. I would do Love Boat during the day. And they'd shoot whatever they could shoot without me. And then they'd wait for me to leave my job in Thousand Oaks to come over to CBS Radford and do the finale. It was one of the most amazing times of my career.
Well, you've had a lot of amazing times in your career. And something else that I thought was interesting, you have quite a strong connection to Star Trek. Now, let me see if I've got this right. When you were 7 years old, you appeared in the original TV series in a season one episode called Miri, and you played Trainee Foster in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. And you were in two episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, playing Ramada Klan and Thopok. And you played Lieutenant John Kelly in Star Trek Voyager. Have I got that right?
You got it all right. Done.
You must get a whole truckload of fan mail from Star Trek fanatics.
I do. I get a great deal of respect from them. I mean, every episode, I only did one episode of each one of those things that you mentioned. So I wasn't in their home every week for years, like Michael Dorn or you know, LeVar or any of the amazing actors that were on the show. But the episodes I've done have been quite seminal and have resonated deeply with the fans. And I get it. You know, I'm a comic book fan. I'm a sci-fi fan. I'm a fantasy fan. There's no one who needs to be more pleased with the performance than myself. And if I'm happy with it, then I think the fans will be. And I've been lucky enough and grateful and honored to be in many, many iterations of Star Trek. And I will always go whenever they call. They are morality plays. They are brilliant. And as an actor, there is no greater material to get involved with than in the Star Trek universe, really.
Well, and it's not just Star Trek. I have to mention, of course, your portrayal of Martian Manhunter on Smallville. You got to fulfill every child, including mine, dream, and you were on screen with Superman. What did it feel like to fly on screen?
Stop it, because when I saw in the editing process, right, you shoot it and then you go and you put voices on the thing, they show the picture and it shows me flying out of the Kent barn. I must have had them run that back like 5 or 6 times.
Run it back.
They're like, Phil, okay, cool. We got to do work now. I'm like, I don't care. Run it back. Because I really am that kind of person. If I were to be floating above my bed tomorrow, if I woke up and I'm floating above my bed and I'm like, wow, I have the power of flight, I think to myself, I knew it all along. I can do it all along. I live life like that in the magic area. So to do shows like Smallville, Star Trek, Justice League, Doom Patrol, and to play these characters or opposite characters like a Superman. For me, the greatest reward was the comic book of Smallville. And my character with my face is in the same frame as Batman. And so, yeah, I'm all about that, man. I pinch myself all the time. I'm doing the heavy lifting for you guys.
Yeah, we really do live vicariously through you, just so you know. Now, of all the characters you've played, Phil, is there one that most closely resembles the real Phil Morris?
Outside of the fact that he's not that funny, John Jones, I think, you know, John Jones. He's super compassionate. He's grounded. He's physical. He's humble. He's confident.
He's sincere. Smart,
sincere, trustworthy, authentic. All those things that I hope I am or I'm working towards, those are qualities that I really love in him. And I think that of all the characters I played, he possibly comes the closest outside of the fact that he wasn't a very funny guy and he wasn't very light with it all. But all the other characters are a little too extreme. Like Jack is not really who I am. He has a lot of me in him, but he isn't who I am. He doesn't hold my beliefs, my values in a way. John does. Tyrone Jackson does from Young and the Restless, do you know? I would be the person who would risk his life to try and save the city or save a person, or, you know, I feel like I am on a hero's journey. And so a lot of these heroes that I play, I honor them, and I'm always excited to have a journey in their shoes.
When I look at your career, you've worked with almost everybody in the industry. So I'm just wondering, is there anyone you haven't worked with yet that you would like to work with?
Oh, there's so many. Yeah, there's so many. I mean, but thank you. And thank you for that. I have had a long career. There's so many people I'd like to work with. I mean, so many directors I'd like to work with that are just, you know, just dynamite. I'd love to work with Quentin Tarantino and Scorsese. And I'd love to work opposite of Brad Pitt, you know, or Robert Downey Jr., a Matt Damon, a Denzel. I mean, there's so many wonderful actors. Idris Elba, Jonathan Majors, even though he's had his share of issues with the world, I think he's a brilliant actor, and I think he's been a little hard done by. He's a tough life, man. Anyway, people like that. I've worked with a lot of females that I would love to work with again. Wanda Sykes, Taraji P. Henson, I've never worked with. I'd love to work with her. She's a force of nature. Halle Berry. I almost had a chance to work with her on, it was called Go Beverly, but then they changed it. But I'd love to work with her. I think she's just beautiful and a force of nature, and so many. I'm not done.
Not only are you not done, we've got something else to manifest. Now, you've done a lot of voiceover work, an enormous amount of voiceover work, both for animated shows and video games. Do you enjoy that as much as acting in front of the camera?
I don't think I do, no. I love it. And I think it's a lot of fun. I love walking, talking, being, connecting. That's hard to do with a mic in front of you. It's limiting, put it that way. I love it. And I love the people I work with. Some of the most talented people I've ever worked with are voiceover talents. But I'm a 3D guy. I need to look at people and see them look back at me. I need to talk to them and have them talk back to me. I need to walk in spaces that exist in this particular construct we're making. I love working with the departments and the camera and sound and lighting. And I've gotten out of the really, you know, accommodating actor syndrome, which is like, am I okay? Am I sharp? Am I light? No, that's their job. They will tell you. You do your job to the best of your ability. Serve the piece and the character. They'll capture it. And when I made that realization, my work just flourished, because I was more excited about the work of the actor than I was being the, you know, Johnny Nice Guy kind of a thing. And I love living on sets. I love being in my trailer. I love waiting. I love, you know, Phil, you ready? And I'm like taking my little 5 minute nap. I'm like, yep, ready to go. I just love it. I love showing up early. I love the bell when we have to be quiet. I mean, I love the life.
I think it's so cool that you do animation voiceover because, as you mentioned, you have this huge collection of comic books. Would you have liked to have been an animator?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. We had a very good friend of ours, Frank Braxton. Frank Braxton was one of the first African-American animators. He worked for Jay Ward, who did Bullwinkle and Rocky, the Captain Crunch stuff, all the stuff that Jay Ward did. Our uncle Frank was an animator, and he gave me cell upon cell upon cell, which are incredibly expensive now. But I was influenced early. I mean, Charles Schulz was a very early influence. I met him early. Remember, my father, being who he was, allowed me such great access to so many things. I think my first voiceover, I was 10 or 8 or 9, something called Easter Is and Christmas Is. I did a few seasonal ones. So absolutely, animation is in my bloodstream, man. Yeah, I would have loved to have been an animator.
There have been so many changes in the TV and film industry since you first started out. Have you had to change or adjust the way you strategize your career over the years?
Yes, yes, yes. It you have to go with the flow. It doesn't stop for you. You know what I mean? Remember, we started this conversation with my father said, you know, be a team player. And so the team evolves. You lose players, you gain players, you lose coaches, you gain coaches. And I've just been in the game. And you call on me to do what? Drama, I'm there. Comedy, I'm there. And it has evolved. I remember I did a seminar called Phil Morris Gives You the Business. It was everything you think, the good and the bad. It wasn't a casting workshop or an acting workshop. It was just, I wish people would have told me this when I started, kind of a workshop, right? With all young actors, packed every time. And I told an older friend of mine, I was doing this workshop, he goes, "Oh, Phil, we need it, you know, because this new technology sucks, and these self-tapes, I hate self-tapes." And he's just whang, 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 right? And I'm listening. I let him go. And I say, "Hey, imagine, I hear you, but imagine if we started today. We're young out, we start today. What would we know? Only that we have to do this today. We do self-tapes. We do this. We go online. We do social media. We do that. We wouldn't argue like we are because we're 8x10 guys from the past. We would hopefully understand what's in front of us to do today. And I think that's what I've done. I've understood what the task is. I'm no longer a younger leading man. I'm an older leading man. I'm a character actor now. And I'm good with that. And I think the ones that you don't see anymore, they stayed stuck. You know, they fought kicking and screaming. And I don't. I go with this flow and I find the truth in my expression and I try and give that to my characters. So again, grateful.
You know, that's such a healthy perspective. You're very flexible and you're prepared to reinvent yourself and you're not stuck in what used to be. That's incredibly healthy. There's a very strong message in there, not just for the entertainment industry, but every industry.
Life.
Yeah. And on top of all of that, I have to mention that you are a serious car enthusiast. You have a racing license. Of course, your father was the voice of Mercedes-Benz. And I remember he did a Chrysler commercial. And he was the grand marshal of a lot of car events when you were a kid and I was a kid. So was your love of automobiles partly inspired by your dad?
I think absolutely. Of course, I had the kid stuff. I still have my Hot Wheels that I had back then. But because, again, of his access to races like the California 500, the Ontario 500, Riverside 500, and he would be the Grand Marshal or the MC or the Master of Ceremonies, whatever, of the parade, we had incredible access. I met incredible people, A.J. Foyt, Mario Andretti, Steve McQueen, Paul Newman. We were in the pits at a very young age, and I think that absolutely was in my bloodstream. And it motivated me. I am a car fanatic. I wanted so many things, right? That's why I'm an actor, so I can do so many things. I wanted to go to Art Center of Design and study automotive design, which I did for a minute. And so I love the design of cars. I love man and machine and technology and how man integrates itself with machines. And in the car world, that's where you find that and the constant evolution of that. So yeah, I'm definitely a car guy.
Well, I don't know a whole lot about cars, but you strike me as more of a European, international kind of a guy rather than a Mustang muscle car or a Hot Wheel kind of guy. Am I right?
I am. I obviously respect all makes and models, but I'm a Porsche, Ferrari, Audi, European kind of a dude. I love Formula One racing. I've been following it for decades. I love all forms of racing, quite frankly, and I follow them almost religiously. But yeah, I'm an exotic car guy.
And you teach and study martial arts, Wing Chun Kung Fu, correct?
Yes. Wing Chun is my system. I've been training and teaching it since 1988. I had an amazing Sifu, which is a teacher in Chinese. And I studied with him until he passed away a few years ago. And we carry on in his name. His name was Hawkins Chung. Very good friend of Bruce Lee's in Hong Kong, studied with Ip Man together. If you guys know the Ip Man movies made famous by Donnie Yen, that was my Sifu's grandmaster or master. So I'm a lineage, Ip Man lineage student. And I love it. It keeps me together in this business, Harvey. You need something that's bigger than you. You need something that's going to humble you, that's going to ground you, that you're practicing, that you're training, that is perfect, that you will never perfect. Kind of like acting. And it gives you perspective on your day-to-day living, not just your work as an actor, but as a husband, as a father, as a friend, you know, as a brother.
You know, Phil, I have to say, considering that you grew up as a Hollywood kid and you've been a huge success in show business your whole life, you're incredibly down to earth. You don't live a Hollywood party lifestyle. You've been married to your wife, Carla, for 40 years. What do you think has kept you grounded and centered and so humble?
My parents. It's my parents. You know, they came from salt of the earth people. My mother from West Virginia, coal mining country. My dad from Cleveland, Ohio. You know, somehow he had the temerity to think, I can make it in this world, you know. African-American male in the 60s, really? And he did it. And so people like that, my Uncle Bill Wright, He's on the wall over there. He's one of the first African American PGA members. They showed me the possible. They showed it to me with grace and humility, incredible respect and bearing. And so I just hope that I can fill those shoes. And so that's what I'm doing.
But the thing about you, Phil, is that you soaked it up. You actually soaked it up. A lot of Hollywood kids were so entitled and lived such a privileged life in this bubble that they didn't soak it up. They didn't get those values. They didn't appreciate how hard their parents worked to get where they got. And they didn't feel an obligation to carry on and do their parents proud like you do.
I agree. I mean, there are some, not all of us. It's just the nature of the energy around this. You know, that bubble that the entertainment industry puts before all of us is greater than anyone almost in the history of the world. You know, I didn't live in the Holy Roman Empire, so I don't know what that was all about, but I do know that in our industry, the rewards are so amazing. And so we get caught up in that chase. We get caught up in that journey as opposed to what gets us there. How do we get there? Remember, my father told me, don't work, man. Play. Play. Learn what you're doing, respect everybody else, and do your thing. The wins will come. You don't have to pull on people and go, hey, you see how cool I am? You see what I look like? You see how pretty I am? You see how handsome I am? No, they'll find you when you become who you need to be. I mean, this has been my upbringing, and maybe others didn't get it, and maybe they did, and they chose, as you say, not to shoulder those moral upbringing and that kind of support that your family gets. You know, my moral compass is strong, and I was given it by my parents. Of course, I fall down. Of course, I stumble. Of course, I make mistakes. But those are the things that I learn from and teach me the greatest lessons, as opposed to, oh, no, I'm just not going to happen again. No, it's going to happen again. So, you know, don't hold yourself to a standard you can't meet. And so that's who I am, Harvey, and that's I'm lucky to have people who helped instill that in me.
It's very fascinating to me that I don't know if this makes any sense, but, and I don't quite know how to say this. Your father was telling you to let your work speak for itself. Don't live your life as an actor. Does that make any sense? You don't live your life as an actor. You're interested and engaged in a wide variety of activities and endeavors that have nothing to do with acting. And you don't allow the actor part of you to identify who you are.
No, I don't. It is it hits. You know, I go on auditions, I want them. As an actor, as an artist, I want those things. When I don't get them, it hurts me, but I don't hold on to that. And I don't take it personally. I don't think they don't like me. You know, if we both go for the same role, ironic, but if we went for the same role and they like both of us equally, they can only hire one of us. This is the way it is. So it isn't that they rejected me, they just chose you. And if I do good enough work, it will resonate so that the next job that they do, which everybody always has another job, perhaps that will be the time that I'm used. Yeah, I don't live my life as an actor because I'm never going to play an actor, really. I'm going to play people. So I go live my life and I bring my life to my work. So yeah, I race cars. Yeah, I do martial arts. Yes, I love my wife. Yes, I raise my kids. Yes, I have great friends. Yes, I party a little bit. Yes, I do a lot of sports. I'm very physical. I'm very interested in work and art and music and business and those are the things that I carry with me in my work. So no, I don't live my life as an actor. I live my life as a human.
Do you feel comfortable with being famous?
Yes, I do. I do. I like everybody, you know, it has its limits, but don't ask for this heat and then shy away from it. You know, that's not fair. It's not fair to you. It's not fair to the industry. It's not fair to your craft or your audience. And I need resonance. I need a receiver to my speaker, right? I need somebody to hear and honor what I'm doing. I can't just do it myself. And so there's a meet in the middle, right? I have to balance how people see me and how I see myself and not denigrate the people who see me a way I don't see myself. If it's a role that they relate to, I honor what they're telling me and I'm thankful that they're supportive of my work.
That's what really comes across when I talk with you. It's not just the sincerity, the authenticity, that you're so humble. You are filled with gratitude.
Yeah, it's crazy. Look at the life I live. Look at the life I just am fortunate, and I get it. And yes, do I work hard? Absolutely. Because I know the value of the consequence of my hard work. So yes.
Well, Phil, it's been such a pleasure meeting you and having this chance to interview you and to pay tribute to your dear father and to chat with you about your amazing life and career. Thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
It was my honor, Harvey. Anytime you call day or night, we never close. I appreciate you, brother.
I appreciate you too. Our guest has been the renowned actor Phil Morris. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you so much for joining us. See you next time. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my managers, Rick Marcelli and Robin Bragg Marcelli at the Marcelli Company in Hollywood, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my PR directors, Eileen Shapiro and Jimmy Starr, and my entire team at the XPTV One Network in the UK.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.